Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about walking. Now, it's a pretty simple activity, something that certainly has benefits for individuals, has important health benefits for individuals. But there are people who make the argument that if we could encourage people to walk and make our communities more walk-friendly, it would also be good for the community for a variety of reasons. So we have with us this morning someone who is one of the nation's leading experts on walking. His name's Mark Fenton. He is a former editor-at-large of Walking Magazine. He was the host of a series that aired a couple of years back on PBS, America's Walking. He's authored a number of books that have to do with walking and fitness, including The Complete Guide to Walking for Health, Weight Loss, and Fitness. He's also a champion walker. He was a member from 1986 until 1990 of the U.S. National Race Walking Team. Represented the U.S. in many international competitions. He's also done exercise science research, studying the biomechanics of walking. He did that at MIT. After going to school there, he also worked for a number of years at Reebok. I think he continues to be a columnist for Walking Magazine. And now, you know, continues to talk about walking, not only as a kind of evangelist for the health benefits, but also increasingly talking with people in communities, as he is doing here when he's visiting Champaign-Urbana, about promoting walking, making that a part of the mix, the way that people can get around, what you can do in terms of infrastructure to make communities more walkable. And we'll try to talk about some of those things here this morning. I do want to mention as well that he will be giving a talk, and this is a community presentation, so it's open to anybody who is interested. Oh, that was last night? He's now signing to me. Last night. You're correct. That was last night, Mark. Well, okay. Sorry about that. Well, certainly we'll take questions right here. People want to talk about these things. He did indeed give this talk last night. He's also been meeting with people in local government and the folks in the Mass Transit District were very interested in bringing him here. So there are a lot of folks here in our area, as in other communities, that are interested in promoting walking. So this is an opportunity to call in, ask questions, make comments. Any and all of that is certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's great to be here.
Appreciate that. Yeah,
thank you so much for having me.
That was last night. I'm sure it was very good.
It was wonderful. Oh my gosh, I was really on my game. Actually, it was a really good talk too.
Yeah. Well, and here, and I know here we were just talking about this before we got going, but here in this community, and I'm sure it's true other places, There are a lot of folks who are interested in generally speaking, in how people get around.
Right.
And in how we balance all the various modes of transportation, cars, buses, bicycles, skateboards, and pedestrians. And it can be sometimes, I think, a real challenge to make a place for all of that, because all of those things have right. their places, so everybody can get where they're going and get where they're going safely. And you know, in this community particularly, I think there's been a lot of concern about pedestrian safety, how they fit in, you know, and how we make it possible right. for people to get around on foot, which can be a real significant challenge.
And you know, let's be really explicit and let's be blunt about this. There are people who are frustrated at some of the efforts to enhance the pedestrian environment if it makes me have to drive slower. You know, if it's mm-hmm. if you're going to take away space for cars to add space for bicyclists or pedestrians, how can that be efficient? You know, that's a question that gets asked right away. So I usually start the conversation in a different place. I try to pull everybody back and give some context. And the context is pretty simple from a public health perspective. We know that the newly released physical activity guidelines that came out from the Department of Health and Human Services last year summarized and really reiterated a fundamental recommendation that we've been saying for years, which is that all adults should accumulate at least 30 minutes of physical activity a day, that we want everybody to get that half an hour. It can be moderate. It can be broken up over the course of the day. It doesn't mean going to the gym and lifting weights, training for the marathon this weekend. It could be walking your kid to school for 15 minutes in the morning and then 15 minutes in the afternoon walking to pick that child up. It could be walking 10 minutes to the bus, taking a 10-minute walk for errands at work during the day, 10 minutes back from the bus in the afternoon. We know that confers real important health benefits. It'll reduce your risk for cardiovascular disease, for type 2 diabetes, for obesity, for a growing list of cancers. We know women who are active, even that moderate amount a day, are at lower risk for breast cancer, and they're more likely to survive. If diagnosed with breast cancer, if you're physically active, you're more likely to survive through it. The point is, we have this broader context, which is that Americans know we should be physically active. And here's the other side of that coin. Only about 25% of American adults actually get that 30 minutes per day through what we would call leisure time activity. So the big E, exercise, going to the gym, getting out for their run, hopping on their bicycle for an exercise ride. One in four of us roughly get it. So start from that context and say, why does this matter? Well, when we talk about skyrocketing healthcare costs, when we talk about the entire automobile industry in this country imploding because of, in no small part, the healthcare burden that's created by an aging population of employees who have all the chronic diseases associated with sedentary living. You talk about us not being competitive in the world as a nation economically, again, because of these costs associated with healthcare. Then you start to say, holy cow, this is a real issue. This isn't just a matter of personal choice. There are greater social costs associated with us being a really sedentary population. So starting from that, I then try to have a community, help a community think about, okay, what are our priorities going forward? Yeah. You know, how do we build a place where it's easier to get that 30 minutes a day without necessarily saying, I'm going to exercise?
Yeah. Well, that's, I think I've got a caller here when we get to, but I think that that really underscores the point that we have undervalued walking as a fitness activity. Right. And that when people think about exercise, oh, as you say, well, that means I have to go to the health club. It means I have to be on the stationary bike. Maybe it even means I have to be on the treadmill, which, well, that's walking, isn't it? And you're not going anywhere.
Drive to the club, hop on the treadmill for 30 minutes, and then drive back home.
Exactly.
Right?
But that also, though, maybe what you have to do is not only to get people thinking about how that there are those benefits, but things have to be set up to kind of encourage, you know, give people a little nudge to encourage people to do that. And that maybe is the more difficult thing.
In fact, there's research on that. We're not guessing on that anymore. That's some of what I presented this morning, for example. We have evidence that says we can describe places where people are more likely to walk or to bicycle or to use transit intrinsically without consciously making a decision to do it for exercise sake, but because it is actually safer, more convenient, less costly than the alternatives, for example. So we know, for example, a better mix of land uses, so having shopping and schools and recreational opportunities close to where we live, compact neighborhoods, as opprised to kind of traditional modern suburban sprawl where we do one housing subdivision after another, and then at the end of that long suburban block, we put a strip mall or a big box, you know, mall. Well, inevitably, that's going to be a driving trip because those distances are very great and there's no real good connection between them. The second thing is good connectivity, the sidewalk network, pathways, bike lanes, facilities on the ground that make it available, a good network of transit. Third is that the destination itself is inviting. So when you get there, there's a bike rack. You know, you're not going to ride your bike or the sidewalk connects you to the front door of the building. You know, how many giant malls do we know where there's a sidewalk out front, but to get across the parking lot to the front door is like a game of Frogger. You know, you're dodging the cars. And then last but not least, the whole system has to be fairly safe and accessible to all users. For example, even young kids, older people who aren't driving anymore. And if you build that, what we know is that people will, without us scolding them to do it, tend to walk more. You know, if you create that inviting environment, they'll just get out there.
Let's talk with a caller here. We have someone line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hello. Yes, I've got a question. You were lucky enough to study at MIT. This presumably biomechanics. Can you recommend some good textbooks on the physics of walking or human bodily motion?
Yeah, that's a great – wow, what a great question. And indeed, there's one by a guy named Tom McMahon, M-C-M-A-H-O-N.
Wait a minute. McMahon.
Yep. McMahon, Thomas. Okay. And sadly, he's no longer with us. He died a young man in his 50s.
Huh.
But he was a wonderful professor, and I actually had a chance – he was at Harvard when I was at MIT, but I got a chance to work with him a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's called – I think it's called The Mechanics or Biomechanics of Human Locomotion.
Oh,
but the words
great.
Human locomotion are in the title, and he talks about everything from – walking as the base activity, but then he talks about things like rowing and cycling and figure skating. Because there are some really interesting threads in how the human body moves in all these different modes when we move under our own power.
So it's a rigorous mathematical treatment, vectors and all that sort of thing.
Indeed, if I may, I'll digress here for a minute. I studied fluid mechanics, and they use a lot of fluid mechanics modeling techniques, what's called dimensional analysis in the study of human bodies. So there it is.
Wonderful.
A nerd's delight in my case.
Do you happen to know the publisher?
Boy, I don't, I'm afraid.
Okay, I can look that up.
You'll get
okay.
it with McMahon and Biomechanics of Human Locomotion.
Wonderful. Thanks a lot.
Of course.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Mark Fenton, is one of the country's leading experts on walking. He has written books about walking and health. He was host of the PBS series America's Walking. He's former editor-in-large of Walking Magazine. He's been a champion walker, a race walker, and as he explained, has studied the biomechanics of walking at MIT. Also, after graduating from there, spent some time working at Reebok. And we're here talking about walking and the benefits of walking and what communities can do to encourage people to make it easier, at least not have roadblocks to walking. Mm-hmm. Get the roadblocks taken out of there. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm thinking about just recently on the program, we had a conversation with an economist who is particularly interested in health and healthcare. And the thing we were focusing on in this particular conversation was the problem of obesity.
Yep.
And the fact that public policy has actually, one of the unintended consequences of some public policy is discouraging people from being physically active.
That's right.
And I sort of ask a question like, well, what can we do, particularly in urban areas, perhaps to do some retrofitting to encourage people walking? And the thing that struck me about his comments was he was actually very pessimistic about the ability to do that. He essentially said, well, there's really not very much we can do.
Just out of curiosity, who was that guest?
His name
was
is
it Finkelstein.
No, okay. No, it was a guy who's at the U of I Chicago, Bob. Okay. Kestner, I think that it was. It was one of ours.
There are a bunch of economists, health economists, that look at this question, and in general, they are universally pessimistic, is my experience. So I'm not surprised, because they say market forces are really strong. I mean, think about it. Think about just how you buy health insurance. The nature of how we do health insurance in this country is you buy it usually for a lot of money, you or your employer or some combination, and then you only gain the benefit if you use it. So if my choices were to eat a healthy diet and restrict my fat intake and exercise a lot, I tend to have genetically high cholesterol. My family does. And you wouldn't necessarily think it to look at me. I'm reasonably trim. I run. I stay fit and all that. But I walk. So what are the incentives? The incentive for me is go ahead and eat the French fries because I can get the Lipitor for a fairly low, my cholesterol medication. Now that I've paid my insurance, fairly inexpensively. So why should I invest the effort in lowering my healthcare costs if I have to pay this fixed insurance and I'm not rewarded for making healthy choices, not eating the French fries, choosing to go for a walk? So that's one example of where the economic model sends us in the wrong direction. Similarly, the way we do automobile travel in this country, you pay this big fixed cost up front, buy the car, and gas relative to the rest of the world is cheap in this country. So the marginal decision, an economist would say, to hop in your car to drive across town versus to choose to jump, walk to the bus stop or ride your bicycle, it's so easy, it's so convenient to do it with the car. In fact, let's go another step. Have we subsidized the automobile by continually widening roads with our tax dollars to make it easier to move cars to and fro across the community? The answer is yes. So in each case, the economic incentive is to choose the sedentary choice. So I understand their pessimism. There's a counter argument. I mean, I got to be the optimistic guy, right? Mm-hmm. This is what I do. We write a lot of land use codes, zoning ordinances, roadway design guidelines. They're laws that we create, and we can choose to steer them. With those laws, we are doing social engineering. Historically, since World War II, the social engineering we've done is let's build an environment only for the automobile. There is a movement now to say maybe we ought to build an environment that works for all four travel modes, pedestrian, bicyclist, transit, and automobile. It doesn't mean make it bad for cars. It means put some options out there for users. And that's, I think, the really enlightening kind of movement, to go in a direction that does that. Yeah.
So it seems that what this guy that I talked to and a lot of the other people say is that you can't – there's really no good way to – other than – educating people and telling them what they already know about the relationship between health and lifestyle and hoping that they'll do the right thing because it's the right thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
And that's essentially they're saying that there's no, you know, that is that you can do. But other than that, in terms of, you know, legislating the salt and fat content of fat food and, you know, all this other stuff, they'd say that just doesn't work.
Right. I tend to agree that legislative or regulatory approach isn't going to fly.
Right.
I would look at the areas that we already do have regulations. So we already have zoning ordinances. But does the zoning say put the building 250 feet back from the road with acres of parking out in front of it? Or does it say bring the building up to the street, put the parking behind the building, and require that there's some good bicycle parking under the eaves of the building, and there's safe access from the transit stop to the front door of the building? Those are subtle differences, but they define a place that someone might choose to walk or bicycle to the destination or take transit, as opposed to the traditional way we build kind of strip retail or big box retail, which is where the building is back behind acres of asphalt. There's no connection to the front door. There's no bicycle parking. That if you do those things, which is what our standard ordinances in many cases don't just allow but require. So we have a requirement of a 250-foot setback rather than setting the building only 250 feet from the street. Think of the difference between all the big malls out on the perimeter of town and what the downtown feels like. You know, there was a time when we built a different way. In fact, those buildings would never be single-story structures. They'd have been retail on the first floor, and then above those maybe office spaces, and then the top two floors of the building might have been apartments or in the modern era condominiums, right? Well, we can do that again, and in fact, you're seeing some of that. If you look at the downtown redevelopment in Champaign, some of that is really bike and pedestrian friendly in the sense that there are bike racks down on the sidewalks, wide sidewalks. The buildings, in fact, are multi-story housing above retail. So no one can tell me that it can't work. It indeed is. We're seeing that happen. So I think that's what, you know, the other thing is that the economists have to acknowledge we're not looking at a lot of what we'd call external costs. The economics, they talk about external costs. So you don't pay the cost for your heart attack entirely because, you know, I have to when you're on Medicare or Medicaid. It's my taxes that help. So there's a point at which what they know is what economists would say is we have to internalize those external costs. And some health insurance industries, companies are actually looking to do that. They're actually looking to reward those who they insure who choose to be physically active, who eat a healthy diet, who keep their body mass index in a healthy range, blood cholesterol, blood glucose levels in healthy recommended ranges. That may be one of the market-based tools that you see used. Because I'm a big fan of the market. I don't think a regulatory approach is necessarily going to be the example, the answer.
Well, let's talk with some more folks. Next up, somebody in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Yes. I have a question about carrying loads. I know the idea of having shopping and work in walking distance from where one lives is a good idea, but coming back from shopping with bags, I think, is not tolerable to most people. And also a lot of people take their work home in briefcases. I know when I walk out of the house, I might intend to walk, but when I realize how heavy my briefcase is, you know, choose to take a car instead. So just, you know, things, carrying things. What's your suggestion? Maybe better backpacks.
And indeed, a great example of that is kids. We do these walk-to-school programs. One of the sponsors of my visit is the Champaign-Urbana Safe Routes to School Coalition, the group that's working to encourage more kids to walk and bicycle to school, those who live close enough and those who don't, to create physical activity opportunities at schools. But as you can imagine, just as the gentleman said, one of the challenges for kids is I got this big backpack. All my books are in it. I've got to take home history, math, reading. My kids are at that age. I've got an 11 and a 13-year-old. And, you know, it's daunting the size of the backpack. To give you a sense, there are schools that address that problem quite directly with things like shared books in school and letting the books kids take books home and leave them at home. So schools that are consciously trying to encourage more kids to walk and bike have said, let's address this very problem. You know, lighten up the load. Let's put more of the assignments online if that's available to kids, if kids have a good way to access that. Let's do handouts rather than send home the entire book every time. Let's have teachers collaborate. So math and science do Monday and Wednesday, and English and history do Tuesday and Thursday. So there are a host of things that schools have done around that. We have seen groups set up what they call walking school buses, groups of kids that walk together like a school bus. So there's an adult that walks a route to school every day, picking children up along the way. In fact, your Safe Routes to School Coalition is doing that, is setting up walking school buses. Now, for the younger kids, what we've done in some communities is had parents pull a wagon And the kids all throw their backpacks in the wagon. And, you know, no big deal. But now the 10 kids walking from that neighborhood, my wife actually organized one of these. What about grown-ups? Well, we're finding more and more people are working online. You know, they're saying it's just my laptop that I'm carrying. I'm not carrying big sheafs of paper. A high-quality backpack, as the gentleman said, is a great answer. There are really good packs out there. Distribute the load. Put more of it on your hips, which is really where you want it. So things like getting a pack with a waist strap. In fact, if you look at people who are regular bike or foot commuters, they've kind of equipped themselves. They've made the decision. They said, okay, this is how I'm going to get around. So I'm going to spend a few more dollars. I'm going to go to an outdoor store. I'm not just going to pick up a cheesy book bag. I'm going to get a decent backpack, the kind I might use carrying as much as 40 loads when I'm hiking, you know, backpacking in the country. So 40 pounds, I mean, you know, if I'm carrying 40 pounds on my back hiking, I can carry 20 pounds of books to and from work every day. So getting a pack which has what they call the lumbar support, a padded hip strap, what's called a sternum strap that allows you to close it in front of your chest so that the load sits properly on your back, fitting it, you know, those things can all make a big difference. But it is very much about equipping yourself and acknowledging. Bicyclists, for example, they're not carrying their weight up on their back. They're using panniers, you know, those bags that keep the weight low down at the center of the wheel, hanging on the side, the saddlebags next to the wheels. All answers that one can use. I mean, I've even seen a wonderful bike trailers, you know, for the people who choose to commute by bike that carry tremendous loads. I used to pull my kids in one. So, you know, you can certainly deal with those issues. They're perfectly valid questions, but they're solvable problems. Yeah.
We have somebody who clearly is listening to us on the web because I'm told they're in France.
Ah.
Line number two. Well, where are you calling from? Line two?
I'm calling from Brittany, just outside of Brest on the west coast.
Well, welcome. You have a question, comment?
I did, yeah. I wanted to point out some differences I've noticed between Urbana-Champaign and France, where I've just been living for a few weeks. There's a lot more walking and cycling here, despite the bad weather. We get a lot of rain here, but it doesn't seem to keep people inside. So some of the things that I've noticed is that there are paths between the streets, so you don't get these places where you have to walk down busy streets. There's always a path going back to another street that's not connected by a street, you know, in between houses. There are bike lanes on the streets, right on the street, so you don't have to worry about cars pulling out to hit you like when it is when they're on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. The things are a reasonable distance apart. The streets are narrower, so there's just a general feel that the car is not king. There's a lot of covered bike parking, I've noticed, mm-hmm. which is nice because we do get a lot of rain. So if it rains, if it's not raining in the morning and you take your bike, then, you know, you can count on it staying dry all day. And then there's, in our little village, there's a great bike and walking path that connects places that people actually go. So from my house, I can ride my bike or walk to the grocery store, the post office, the library, and the city hall almost entirely on a bike path that goes back through a neighborhood and avoids the major street that I would take if I were driving. So anyway, those are just some things that I really appreciate here. And I did do a lot of walking and cycling in Urbana-Champaign, but I have to say that aesthetics makes a difference too, even in a short walk. If you're walking across a parking lot, it feels like it takes about five times longer than it does if you're walking through a park or something. So anyway, I'll hang up and listen to the rest of the program online. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for the call. Thanks for the story.
Those were great observations, and they really are threads that we see. There's actually research evidence to support her observations. Her observations are very astute. You know, this notion, for example, of connecting between streets, what we're really trying to do, one of the very simple things, back to the notion of what are there policy changes that we can suggest that are not draconian? Simple things like when we build a new subdivision, actually requiring those cut-through pathways. Because, back to an economist, what they would say is you're increasing the marginal utility of a walking trip when you can walk between blocks on a shortcut but would have to drive out of your way around the full block, as the roadway network would make you do. It's actually an easier choice to say, well, why don't I walk? Because it actually ends up being the shorter, more convenient trip. And that's what she's experiencing by virtue of those little connector paths. There's some recent research that was in Planning Magazine earlier this year, or 2008, I should say, that talked very much about this functional connectedness that she described. She said, you know, these trails aren't just recreational corridors for out on the perimeter of town for people to go ride for exercise on Saturday morning. They connect to the library, the post office, the coffee shop, the restaurant, the school, the city hall. That's critically important, and they see that again in the research in the U.S. Lest people think, well, that's the French. They're different than us. You know, we would never do that. We've got lots of evidence from communities, and they did a great trail study, and they looked at Chicago, they looked at Dallas, they looked at Los Angeles, the L.A. to Long Beach Trail, the White Rock Trail in Dallas. And what they found was just what this young woman said. When the trail is well connected to the street network, sidewalks, bike lanes, pathways, and to destinations, it got lots and lots of use because now you got both recreational or health walkers out there. People are just going out because they wanted to for their well-being. But you got all those functional users too. The interesting thing, I thought she might be calling from Paris because talk about an amazing experiment. They have gone a step further and said, let's put in place a municipal bicycle fleet. It's in bike racks all over the city. All you have to do is swipe your card, basically your credit card, to pull one out. The first half hour is free. As long as you go to another one of those bike racks, slide your card and put it back in. They're all GPS equipped. So they know the bike you took. When you return it, if you've done it in half an hour, it's free. And it's only a nominal cost for the first couple of hours. The whole intent of the system is for people to use them for short trips around the city. And just so you know, there are people talking about the fact that this would be a great place to do that. That with all the university students and all the local capacity that you have and the shortness, relative shortness of the distances, a bike share program like that might be a good idea here. I think it's going to be really interesting to see if that goes anywhere. But I can say that cities like Stockholm and Paris that have done it and others in the U.S. like Buffalo and Louisville, Kentucky that are exploring it, it shows great promise.
We are just a little bit past our midpoint. I have another caller we'll get right to, but I do want to reintroduce the guest for anyone who has tuned in the last 5, 10 minutes or more. Our guest is Mark Fenton. He is one of the nation's experts on walking, former editor-in-large of Walking Magazine, host of a PBS series, America's Walking. He's been a champion race walker for the U.S. national team. He's the author of a number of books that have to do with walking and health, and is here visiting in our area, Champaign-Urbana, to talk with local folks, people in local government, people in the local mass transit district, people in education, all folks who are interested in, for one reason or another, promoting walking. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have another caller here. This is someone in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call, David. The subject is wonderful. I have spent my whole life exercising my body and my brain. And early on, I worked in gas stations with concrete driveways when you pumped the gas and washed windows and did. And that was total exercise all the way from 12 hours a day to 8 up to 90 hours a week. And then I drove a truck, light delivery, and walked back and forth with that. Then I went to work at the university in Charleston. And 10% of the day was heavy lifting, and the other was you were busy there most of the time. And then before I retired from there, my wife, who is a registered dietitian, began to tell me, you need some exercise. Mm-hmm. And 15 years ago, and in the interim of this all, I built 2 houses and a couple of outbuildings and restored one from a wreck, which I'm sitting in making this call, out of scrap, and which was the equivalent of 4, because the time you salvage, tear down, salvage, and recut and reconstruct, then you're really busy. So I have been doing that all my life, those sorts of things, and raised a large family. And then 15 years ago, my dietitian wife said, you know, you really need to be doing some more exercise. Well, don't I get enough? Well, no, it's got to be consistent. So from that time, 15 years ago, until now, I walk up to 1.5 miles a day, 6 days a week. And when I get home, I do 150 to 170 light push-ups. I don't touch my nose on the floor, but I do that after I walk. And then I read my paper, and then I get going with other things. But I guess I've had other problems, too. But nevertheless, next month I'll be 75 years old.
75 years young, it sounds like. I, the only question I have is sort of how do we get this gentleman to sort of lead a group on this and his routine? That 1.5 miles a day, you know, those physical activity guidelines I mentioned a moment ago that came out from the Department of Health and Human Services just last summer would say – he's got it pegged because he's got a moderate amount of daily aerobic activity, that mile and a half of walking. It's consistent 6 days a week. And one of the things the guidelines say is consistency does indeed matter. Your RD wife is right on the target there. We know that the person, for example, the weekend warrior, a lot of activity on Saturday in the softball league or whatever, and then not much else the rest of the week, probably not as much benefit as the person who is moderately active but all the time. Helps greatly with things like calorie balance. You know, we hear about our so-called obesity epidemic, which is really this epidemic of inactivity combined with an epidemic of poor eating, right? So we end up with a caloric imbalance. So that moderate daily dose and then adding a little muscle strengthening, particularly as we age, is really important because helps maintain muscle mass and, in particular for women, maintain bone density. So some resistance training like his push-ups, it could be calisthenics, it could be light weightlifting, even working with those exercise bands that you've seen. Any of those are all good choices. What I like to remind people is it can also be functional physical activity, that the person who is active, again, as part of their daily transportation or as their job. So when he was being a delivery person, you know, those steps counted, quote unquote, you know, when he was walking to and from destinations and deliveries, that counts. So yeah. I think it's important that we remind ourselves of that because so often we think it doesn't count if I'm not in the gym somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I think you know, that might also help with the problem. And I'm sure that a lot of folks who have said, well, I have decided for a number of very good reasons that I want to increase my physical activity and I want to have some regular exercise. I think a lot of people would say one of the big challenges is how do you work that into your
day?
Into your day? I mean, how do you find time to do it?
I'm helping a lot of what I do when I do personal counseling with folks is I help them do their commuter calculus because I say this. Let's imagine you're supposed to be active between 30 and 60 minutes a day. We know, by the way, the benefits continue to increase as you increase the time. So 30 minutes minimum recommendation. I personally target an hour of day. And what I tend to find is some of that is a little bit of exercise time, but most of it I'm getting functionally. So if I've got an hour to play with, the question is, if my daily commute by car took 20 minutes and to ride a bicycle or do some combination that included the bus took me up to 40 minutes, it doubled my commute time. But of that, 30 of those minutes were active, you know, because I was walking to and from the bus stop or riding my bicycle, then indeed I've actually come out ahead on the deal, right? I added 20 minutes to my commute time in both directions. That's a 40-minute additional cost. But bingo, I've solved my 60-minute of day physical activity goal, right? Because I'm exceeding that when you put all the physical activity together. People forget that. They don't think about the time we spend traveling and being quite sedentary if we're doing it in an automobile as a lost opportunity. But it really is. You know, that time we spend. In fact, you know, there's a fairly strong correlation as we've seen vehicle miles traveled in this country go up and as we've seen commute times and commute distances go up. That's been the same time span that we've seen America's so-called obesity epidemic. Mm-hmm. And I think it's contributing. It's one of the contributing factors. That's all sedentary time.
We have somebody, we have several other people here calling in. Somebody on a cell phone. They're on the road here on line number one. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, all the ideas you're putting forward are great. I might point out, however, there are ideas that people have been putting forward for 50 or 60 years.
Yes, sir.
So the real question is why have they never been implemented? And I would say it's much more of a political question than a lack of ideas. And the main culprit in all of this is the auto industry, going way back to when they tried to set up Ralph Nader with a prostitute and their billions of dollars over the years that they've spent crushing anything that would interfere with sales of automobiles and, in addition, building of highways and urban sprawl. Right. Talk about destroying community life and health. Urban sprawl is what's done it. And we subsidize people who live in suburbs with highways and long, expensive water lines and long, expensive electrical lines. And it's all paid for from the general good so that they can destroy farmland and build houses and sell more cars. Now, maybe with the auto industry on its knees, they won't have time to meddle in national politics in this fashion like they've done for years. But I'm never too optimistic about that.
Unfortunately.
We shall see.
The conspiracy theorist in you just doesn't let that happen,
it's
right?
It's not a theory. It's a fact.
It's it really is an amazing phenomenon. We can look at things like the Federal Highways Act. I just read a wonderful biography of Eisenhower. You know, he came back from World War II, Dwight Eisenhower, president, and one of his acts that he was fairly proud of was the passage of the first federal highway bill, which actually was called the National Defense Transportation Act. He had seen the Autobahn when he was over there in Germany as World War II was winding down. He said, man, as we move into this Cold War with Russia, remember the mentality, we may have to evacuate the coastal communities, cities under a Russian attack. We may have to move men and materials across the country if we were ever in a shooting war with Russia. We need a network of interstate highways. So that's what, you know, it was a well-intended thing. And by the way, they allow me, the interstate highways allow me to eat a banana in Boston in the middle of winter and an orange, right? And we can truck healthy foods across this country. And so, but one of the unintended consequences is just as the gentleman points out, this unintended suburban sprawl. It made it so easy to escape the cities that combined with this kind of approach to single-use zoning where we segregate housing from where we work, from where we – which, by the way, was also thought to be a good thing. Single-use zoning had its turn of its roots – much of its modern roots at the turn of the century when we were actually reducing the housing densities in the tenements of the big cities, which were, if you remember, breeding grounds for infectious disease. When the 1918 flu pandemic just devastated this country and much of the world, it just blew through the high density urban tenements of the city. So lowering density, spreading people out into single family homes was seen as a health thing. Similarly, separating where we live from where we work, because remember, factories were dirty. You didn't want a factory in your backyard, so let's do housing over here and commercial over there. So that single-use zoning model became the norm. And again, unintended consequence, I can't walk to work. My kid can't walk to school. I can't ride a bicycle to go shop because we've stuck with that model. So the really interesting question is, and I think his first point is the most important, this is never about the money. I have worked in communities all over the country, and people say, oh, well, this is going to cost striping these bike lanes and building these bike paths. My God, it's more money than we have, especially in an economic downturn. Baloney. There is lots of money out there. In fact, lots of stimulus dollars is available to be spent on this stuff. They have earmarked. And they said, yeah, use it for green infrastructure. How many times have we heard the green, the 21st century infrastructure? The issue is, where's the political will? Will people step up? And I think you have an interesting thing going on here, if I may make an editorial comment about Champaign, Urbana. You've got these three power bases, basically, Urbana, Champaign, and the university. They're sort of three different entities. And one of my first recommendations is you guys really need to pull together a coalition of the big thinkers and the leaders in those entities, along with people from everything from transportation to public health to the schools to your planning and engineering entities, and have a real dialogue about, do you want to make this a model of health? Because I think this community could be a model of healthy living in the U.S. I mean, kiddingly, we were talking about this. You guys could be America's Netherlands because you're flat. You know, your winters aren't that severe. I mean, I know it's cold here, but it's not like we're up in, Duluth, Minnesota or something where you got 3 feet of snow all winter long. And it could be a place in which walking and bicycling were absolutely the norm. And you're not that big either. It's not like you've sprawled out that far, although it is so disconcerting to go out on the perimeter and see these cornfields being plowed under for another batch of McMansions that sort of, you know, every trip will be an automobile trip to or from those. You know, they're attached to nothing. Uh-huh. But it's about political will. You guys just have to decide this would be your priority. And I would challenge you as a community to do that, to sort of get past the money being the barrier and say, we want to be a healthy community because we know that's economic sustainability. You know, if you want to talk about what economic sustainability is, this should be part of your economic development initiative.
Well, this – and I promise I got some other calls I want to get to. But to coming back to the money question, it seems that, yes, some of the things that we're talking about, if we're really talking about redoing roadways and sidewalks, yeah, that might run into some money. I don't know how much money. Mm-hmm. But that if we're talking, though, about constructing bike paths or paths for walking – there may be all kinds of issues with rights of way and, sure, and so forth and so on, but I wouldn't think that would be that – those no. kinds of things would be that expensive. And overall, I don't know that we're – are we really talking about a lot of money?
I mean, take one of the parking decks that you're building in the downtown district and sort of turn that into support for the other three travel modes. You do a vast amount of other infrastructure work. Now, people say, we need more parking downtown. I've got the businesses to thrive. I'd say you need bodies downtown. What makes the downtown businesses successful is people there to purchase. And there can be a lot of ways. They could live there. You know, you could do more of this residential mixed-use development. They could walk. They can bicycle. They can take transit. And they can drive a car. So there are five different ways that I can have a body be proximate to a downtown business district. And to only focus on one – bringing in more cars from the suburbs by creating more parking, I think you cut off your nose to spite your face, because what you've essentially said is, and I don't care if it's unpleasant or even difficult for the other four ways that we could generate downtown business. So that's where the dialogue has to change. And look at what you're spending on. Same decision happens all the time when we make a decision about a new school. Let's build the school on the cheap land that we got in a land swap with a developer out on the perimeter of town, giving us that land for free, not expensive. Now that's going to be a super cheap school. Unless we calculate the transportation costs over the lifetime of that school, because every child has to either be bused or driven there by a parent. And let's add a health cost, a fact that a disease that we used to call adult onset diabetes, which we now call type 2 because we're seeing it in 9, 10, 11-year-old kids, that we've increased the risk for all those kids if they get no physical activity, if they can't walk to and from school. So if you put those costs together, you start to think maybe that quote-unquote cheap school on the perimeter of town isn't as cheap as we thought.
Yeah. Let's go on to another caller here, line number 2 in Champaign. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. I just got back from 4 months in Portugal, where I left 20XX pounds.
Yes, good for you.
Yeah, mostly because you walk to get where you need to go. Mm-hmm. And I myself prefer a backpack, but I noticed many, many, many people using these, like, shopping bags that are on wheels. And
right.
They about, you know, hip high, and they, you know, they cart them onto the train and the ferries and the metro and the buses, and they just do all their shopping that way.
You're talking about very subtle shifts that people have to make in their habits, but you're absolutely right. Once they figure it out, similarly, you know, you say, well, people, you know, this is all nice, well and good that it's springtime here and it's lovely, but in the middle of winter, Mark, nobody's going to do this. Well, they get decent coats. They get hats and gloves. They, you know, businesses have a different attitude about how you have to dress for work even. You know, women don't feel compelled to necessarily wear high heels or wear a dress. I mean, any of those kinds of changes can make it easier, subtle, but easier for the person
who... And we're talking about not smooth sidewalks in this. We're talking about not exactly cobblestones, but
yeah,
but inlaid stone that you're walking over. So it keeps your ankles strong because you're having to balance a lot better.
You're burning more calories. There are research studies that say walking over rough-hewn ground or rock like that, you are. And, you know, it's weird. On the one hand, you'd say, well, that's not fair for the elderly. But what happens is people who have grown up for generations in that kind of an environment, they've probably built up the skill, the balance, the strength to negotiate it well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much for this discussion today. I've really enjoyed it.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is Farmersburg, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I appreciated this, too. And I also appreciate the the value of walking for exercise and bodily care, but I wonder if you'd read a little book by Henry David Thoreau on walking, in which he, it's more sauntering. I know I walk, 3 or 4 miles every day, and I put my binoculars on, and I may walk a mile and 3/4 or 2 miles an hour, but and I'm sure it provides exercise, but that's really not why I walk. I walk for my soul, I guess.
That's great.
And I'd like for you to comment on if you've read that little book and this other reason for walking. You know, it's a healing activity to one's own consciousness, it seems to me.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad you said it, because
I'll hang up.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
I'm so pleased, though, because you're right. In fact, the essay, I'd recommend it to anybody. It is striking. In fact, a weird little thing. There was a passage in there that I found very moving, and my wife and I actually had read at our wedding is one of the readings. We actually had Thoreau quoted there, talking about, and indeed, just as you said, that making that spiritual connection. He talks about walking through life, and I won't even try to paraphrase it, but just lovely. I think you're right. And I agree completely. I mean, it is my meditative time. You know, not all my walks are exercise walks. I'm not always trying to go fast. I tell people that can be very individual, personal, you know, time alone. It can be very meditative. Some people are very spiritual and find that to be a great contemplative time. Another way I found it to benefit in the same vein is that I walk with my daughter to school. Any day I'm not traveling for work, I have an old 13-year-old son, 12-year-old daughter, 11-year-old daughter, and her school is about 0.6 of a mile away. And I find it's really great time for us together, that it's shared time. And we aren't even necessarily talking the whole time we're walking, just being together, sometimes in silence, just enjoying the nature. I live in a coastal community south of Boston. We're lucky enough that it's quite lovely. You know, we can watch how the tides change, things like that. And As well as the seasons change over the course of the year, all of which Thoreau talks about, you know, being a much more keen observer of your world when you're out on foot. And I really think that's true. And I'd go a step further beyond just personal spiritual healing. I think more people walking can help heal a community. I would submit that when I pass somebody on the street on foot, I'm more likely to make eye contact, say hello, engage with them, even in a very modest way. Whereas if I drive by them in a car, the gesture that I make is much less likely to be a friendly wave, unfortunately. And that's just the nature of the beast, you know. And I think we miss that opportunity if we aren't more out and about on foot.
One more caller, at least, Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Before I go to the mandatory autobiographical part of the show, my discourse, I guess, there's a website called Transition Champaign County, or you can Google something like that. Mm-hmm. Might be an idea. I don't know if that came up in your talk or your or the call-in so far, because I wasn't able to hear all of it. But it's a place where people are talking about these kind of issues.
Right. Yeah, and I'd commend that, you know, to keep that dialogue going, because I think there's a lot of good thinking going on in the community around this.
Right. But for the people who are not necessarily old, the people that have chronic pain, I can't walk because I have an ankle problem. So I've bicycled to swim laps now, and I'm gotten off of the negative feedback of, you know, not being able to get the exercise I need to get trimmer so I can get more exercise or whatever. But so there are a lot of people that are excluded. That doesn't take away from the any of the public policy things. I think the integrated transit system sort of concept is good for people with low mobility as well. It's just the option. The
right.
Most surreal thing, I think, is to see people who drive to a health club and then get on the get on the treadmill. So I just wanted to share the first part of that mostly. And thank you very much.
Well, let me follow that thought just quickly, because another interesting point, not everybody has to turn into a hardcore walker, bicyclist, transit user for this to be beneficial. So the person who says, well, I would never ride my bicycle in one of those bike lanes, or I would never walk on one of those trails. I think they're too scary. I think you can get beat up at night walking on those trails. Now, there's no evidence about that, but and sometimes people are just responding viscerally. Let me say this. Remember that if somebody else chooses to ride their bike, and that means their car is off the road, if somebody else chooses to walk to take transit and they ease congestion in the community, we all still collectively benefit. So the very fact that you may not walk, but you occasionally ride a bicycle and indeed are not making a drive to the pool, but riding the bike to the pool, that's one less car on the road for somebody who does have to be using the car that day. Because I may walk my daughter to school most days, but the day we're carrying a big science project, I might drive. And if most of the time I'm not on the road and others do the same, on the rare occasion when I do have to drive, we don't have a horrible traffic jam in front of the school because there are 60 cars lining up to drop off or pick up kids, because we're only using it when we need to. So not everybody has to turn into the Lycra-clad, I ride my bike 20 miles to and from work every day right through the winter, hardcore, you know, active commuter. God bless those people, and I think it's great, and I'm thank goodness we have them. But if you're the person who a couple days a week ride your bike when you're not carrying a lot and you don't have to dress up really fancy for work and it's easy to do, well, if you did that 2 days a week, that would be a 40% reduction in your commute trips, right? 2 out of 5 days, 40%. We don't see 40% reductions in commute trips for all the initiatives we've done all over the country. You know, I mean, that's a giant change. So I think people can think in terms of incrementally how they personally can benefit or how the community can benefit.
Yeah. Hey, we've talked about the fact that here in, say, in Champaign, Urbana and the area, there are a lot of people who are very concerned about the quality of life in the community, and they're concerned about the environment, and transportation is a part of that, and there are a lot of other things that are part of that too. But that makes me think about, well, what is critical mass? When do you – at what point, many people do you have to get on board with the project to get past the point where you do things like this? And we talk about how it would be nice to do a lot of things, you know, getting to the point of where you actually have momentum enough to see something actually happen.
That's a great question. And sadly, of course, there's no simple answer. But I can say this. In my work around the country, I've seen a couple different models, one of which is the leadership model, where somebody like a mayor, a county commissioner or two step up and say, we're going to own this thing. And this is a healthier community. And often they'll partner with something like the Economic Redevelopment Authority. So it won't be the usual suspects. You'd be surprised. It's not, you know, everybody assumes it's the health folks. Well, not necessarily. Maybe it's the economic development folks who get – a sustainable Champaign-Urbana looks like one in which car isn't just the king, that we have lots of good things working here, including automobiles, but not just. They see that picture. They see what the 10-year, 20-year lifespan of that looks like. They champion it, and then you work from the policy level. You start to say, let's change zoning and codes and ordinances. Let's change what our site design standards are. Let's continue to healthily fund transit, you know, things like that. They make those decisions. So often the critical mass is not just the populist piece, or if there's a populist piece, it's because they're electing officials who in leadership positions then move forward. I would say this. I was very encouraged. I met people in planning, in engineering, in public works who philosophically and technically understand this stuff. So You're seeing roads change, right? You're seeing roads like Philo having been redesigned from a four-lane to a three-lane alignment with center turning lanes and with pedestrian crossing islands and bike lanes. And I know that that ruffled a lot of feathers, but indeed what you're going to see over time is that it's actually more efficient. It reduces the number of vehicle collisions. It actually motor vehicle flows are more efficient there, and it works better for pedestrians and bicyclists as well. So you've got that. I think what you need is to show up at those public meetings. Give the elected officials a little bit of political cover. So when they're willing to put their neck out and say, I want to see this happen, let's do more of these here. Let's fund the continuation of that trail. Let's say yes to this kind of downtown redevelopment. And let's say no to that big sprawling mall out on the perimeter by the interstate. Let's actually pull back a little on that. Or let's make it look like a village if we're really going to design it, a walkable, connected villages to those neighborhoods. They need political cover. They need people to show up at those planning meetings. And sometimes as few as 50 or 60 people showing up at a planning zoning meeting, at a city council meeting, can make the difference. That's more about what it is. I think painting the vision and then, you know, having some of the key players really get it. The critical mass is at the key player level.
Yeah, all right. Well, we're at the end of the time. I'm sure if people want to read more on this subject, you can go out and maybe look at some of the books that Mark Venton, our guest, has authored. He's written a number that have to do with walking and health, like The Complete Guide to Walking for Health, Weight Loss, and Fitness, The 90-Day Fitness Walking Program, Precision Walking, The New Walker's Logbook. So you can go to the library, you can go to the bookstore and look for those. Mark is one of the country's leading experts on walking, former editor-in-large of Walking Magazine, host of a series that was on PBS not very long ago, America's Walking, here visiting in the community to share some of his experience and his thoughts with folks here who are concerned about these very issues. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.